Hello and welcome to the Dream Swarm podcast. This is your home for supernatural film, stories and art. I'm your host, magic realist filmmaker Andy Mark Simpson. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. Welcome everyone to the next episode of Dream Swarm. I'm really pleased today to be joined by Derek from the Midnight Myth podcast on this episode. So welcome, Derek.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for coming on. So for our audience who might not know the Midnight Myth, hopefully we're going to introduce them to that in a bit more detail. So could you firstly introduce yourself and then let us know what the Midnight Myth podcast is and what it's all about?
Yeah, absolutely. So coming to you from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in the United States, I'm Derek. I'm 40 years old. I am a father. My son was just born this January, so he is almost 6 months old at this point. I live with my wife, Laurel. We both have jobs, and we both have creative and academic backgrounds that we don't get to use in our day-to-day work. So we started the podcast. It's been going on for about 5 years now, give or take. And we started the podcast, The Midnight Myth Project, as a way to kind of flex some of those creative and academic muscles that we weren't using and applying it to our favorite stories. The idea of the Midnight Myth is to track down and find the perfect story in whatever form that is. And what are the components that make a story perfect? Every week, well, we used to do it every week and then Arthur was born. So now we're doing, you know, 2 to 3 a month. So we've had to slow it down a little bit. The idea of the Midnight Myth podcast is we pick a piece of artwork. It can be a movie, it can be a book, it can be a play, it can be anything we want it to be, and we dissect it. We do a lot of work using comparative mythological skills. In particular, we use a lot of Freud, we use a lot of Joseph Campbell in our analysis, tools like that. And we're always looking, our three main subjects that we analyze everything through are history, mythology, and philosophy. And we pick those three because those are the three that we're most passionate about. Laurel is huge, huge, huge into myth. I'm huge into history. And we both have a sort of like philosophy in the middle there as another interest. And that's really it. We just talk about the stuff that we love.
Yeah, and it's a really entertaining podcast. And as I say, it goes into a lot of depth of analysis through these different lenses of those academic skills. And just as examples that I've seen recently, you did the whole series of Harry Potter films and also all the Star Wars ones. And the most recent one that I listened to was Apocalypse Now and all the mythology and philosophy behind that as well. So there's quite a range of different movies on there as well. And you say you use mythology, like how ingrained is mythology in movies? You mentioned Joseph Campbell there, and I'm a screenwriter myself, and Campbell's something that I've referenced in the past and has been taught to me. So how intrinsic do you think this link is with mythology in movies?
My personal opinion is that you can't really understand modern cinema or modern storytelling at all unless you have an understanding of myth. I believe that they are intrinsically linked. For example, and just some fun analysis, you can take a look at a character like Captain America from the MCU, and you understand what makes Captain America, Captain America. Well, he's very patriotic. His main weapon is a shield, which he uses to defend. It's a symbol of defense rather than offense. He is a warrior, but he is only going to use war if it helps other people. And in this, he creates this archetype of what it means to be the perfect American man. That idea itself of communicating a shared cultural value through a story is the bread and butter of what a myth, at least a component of what a myth is. You can link Captain America specifically, if you're a fan of Greek mythology, to the character Perseus. Perseus, who slays the Medusa, Perseus was used to create the ideal model of the perfect ancient Greek man. And what does Perseus use to slay the Medusa? He uses a shield. So his main weapon to do one of his many heroic, but his most famous heroic deeds wouldn't be possible if he didn't have a shield so polished that he could see the Medusa's reflection when he slayed the Gorgon. The Gorgon is a monster that is many-headed with lots of snakes. And what is Captain America's main nemesis? It is Hydra in the MCU. Now, Hydra is more important to the story of Hercules, but it's still a serpent. It still is many-headed, and it still is a vicious symbol of the sort of grotesque side of power, such as the Gorgon, such as the Hydra. And to me, that's all just like, that's fun stuff. You know, if you dig even deeper into it every culture has to tell a story in order to identify who they are. You know, you mentioned our Apocalypse Now movie. If you don't have a narrative of what the Vietnam War is, you're not going to have art around the Vietnam War. And that's where the Vietnam War is very unique in the American story, in the American myth making, because it's a war America lost. It's a war that Americans did not believe they should be fighting. And it's one of the few times where America mobilized a full war effort and lost the will of the people and the support of the people. And from that, you get this breadth of art like Apocalypse Now that are deconstructing and ultimately telling a narrative that the war itself was wrong. And it's the only war in which America fought that has that story attached to it. It's very unique in our history. So even if it's not a direct ancient myth, the idea of creating a shared narrative that's communicated, that communicates who people are, that's trying to get to some type of a truth, whether it's a literal or symbolic truth, I think it's intrinsic in particular in cinema.
So you've linked kind of genre movies in there as well, but it's interesting that you're saying that about, you know, Vietnam War creating these like a more modern version of mythology of America, and that's how maybe that was different to, you know, 20 years earlier doing World War II movies and the cowboy films and that mythology changed. Because it's interesting that you've referenced kind of Greek myths and things, but actually myth making is still happening now, and I see this in Britain as well, and kind of attachment to modern day, to mythology of it, and that mythology versus history, I think, as well. I think the need to create modern myths is sometimes undercuts the efforts to study history. People aren't interested in the real facts of it when the myth is more patriotic or the myth is more exciting. So what do you think? Is there a tension between history and mythology there? Or,
I mean, that's a really awesome question. If I go back to where did history come from and why did people start writing things down? The first like real work of history was a guy named Herodotus. He coined the term history, and he wrote the history of the Peloponnesian, he wrote the history of the Persian Wars, the wars between the Greeks and the Persians and the two Persian Wars. And if you look at that work, it is heavily mythologized. Every single aspect of that history correlates, whether a good thing, a bad thing, a battle won, a battle lost, is directly related to the gods. And the gods are the central characters shaping that war. And the reason ultimately Herodotus concludes that the Persians lose both of those wars is because of hubris, because they believed, the Persians, that their kings were living gods. The gods would not allow them to conquer Greece because the Greeks did not believe that. The Greeks believed that power was constitutionally oriented. So you had a polis, you wrote a constitution, it could be democratic, it could be a tyranny, it could be however you want it, but that's where power came from. It didn't come from god kings. And that's the reason the Persians lose in the view of Herodotus. So history and myth are linked, but even before people started writing things down and codifying history into what we now know as history, myth and history were always one and the same. If you're an ancient, illiterate society and you have a culture, you have a way of life, you want to remember things, you also have downtime where people need to be entertained, people need to be moved, and people need to know who you are. How do you transmit that knowledge from one generation to the next in a pre-literate society? Well, you create mnemonic devices, fancy word for rhymes, and you turn them into songs, and then you sing them, and they're sung at parties, they're sung at festivals, and they're transmitting knowledge from one generation to another. That's how we have the Trojan War. That's how we have all of our knowledge on the Norse gods from Scandinavia, because people did that. And when they were transmitting it into song, it needed to be easy to remember. There needed to be a structure there, because you're not going to remember every single word, but the poet could then just make up things as they were going along. So if they knew the rhythm of the Iliad and you forgot a verse, you would just start free versing it. And then once things started getting written down, it then turns into a true historical work. But the idea of music, art, poetry, storytelling, history, knowledge itself, it all came from this shared tradition of just getting around and telling stories one way or another. So I think if you're going to understand where history comes from, you have to understand it's what's called the mythopoetic roots. the idea of creating an epistemology, a system of knowledge based upon myths and songs. And that's how you teach people who they are. That's how you teach someone how to be a good soldier. That's how you teach someone to be a good king. That's how you teach someone to be a good wife. You know, that's all of that is built into that. And if we go even non-Western, you have that as also in the ancient Indic texts as well, a tradition of song. And then eventually it gets written down. And then from there, we branch out. To an ancient person, there's no clear delineation between myth, history, religion, philosophy. All of these things are one. And over time, we've separated those out. What I like to do is to try to kind of challenge myself and say, what's the value of separating history and myth? Well, history, you can be an academic historian. You can have a career doing that. You can write down and you can debate with other historians. But if the idea is you're trying to transmit truth, a type of truth, myth and history, and from that perspective, they are one and the same. They're just done with different mechanics. So I think history and myth are really, really intimately linked, even if we don't tell myths now to explain our history. But then again, in America right now, there is a current historical debate that's been happening since the end of the Civil War. And that is, who won the Civil War and why was it fought? And there has been a myth called the Lost Cause that academic historians have been writing that have been stipulating that, one, the South didn't actually lose it. It's just waiting for its chance to rise again. Two, it wasn't about slavery at all. And three, that the North was the aggressor and started the war. All three of those myths that exist right now, totally not historically accurate. There's not a single historian alive today that studies it that believes that, but that was the story of the Civil War for centuries, a century, yeah. I should say. You know, so even in then, we see how modern myths can encroach upon that. And yes, it's wrong. And, you know, people that know the history of the Civil War, they like to point out to the Southerners that believe this, and they like to denigrate them and be like, you're an idiot, you're not smart, you don't know your history. But in reality, they're trying to come to grips with the truth. And that truth is, they fought a war over slavery and lost. And when they're trying to collectively understand that, they end up creating a myth that lessens that hurt to them. And so if you understand that myth and history are linked, you can have a, now, don't get me wrong, I don't support the Lost Cause at all, in particular when it's, you know, just racism hidden in another guise. But at the same time, if we understand that myth making and how they're doing it, we can, in my view, have a more generous dialogue around that and say, hey, I know you think this is why this happened, but let's actually have a conversation around it. And so I do think you can't really uncouple them, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that they're always coupled, even if there's different versions of it, there is a link there. From what you're saying there about the South and the Civil War, I can really see parallels with Britain at the moment. There's big discussions going on now, similar to what there was in America, where they're looking at the legacy of slavery and things. There was a statue pulled down of a slave trader, and they were like, we don't want the statue anymore. The council hadn't removed it, so the people went and pulled it down. I mean, it was kind of what is the, you know, the myth making there, and what is the actual study and reality of it, and kind of those conflicts between people who want to promote a certain mythology of it, believing that to be history, but and not looking at both sides of history and digging deeper into there as well. So definitely linked together, I think, in that modern day mythologizing of events as well.
Same things happening here. So I live in Philadelphia, and there is a huge Philadelphian Italian immigrant community. And there's a really prominent park that has a gigantic statue of Columbus. And the Italian community has been very politically organized. They actually got an entire street renamed from Delaware Avenue to Columbus Boulevard to celebrate Columbus. And then with Black Lives Matter, there's been huge protests to get that statue torn down, which still is standing. But for some reason, the compromise was now it's covered. So the statue is there, but they just put a big box around it. But yeah, same thing. Like, to what degree should we venerate Christopher Columbus here in America? And what's the myth of Columbus? What's the reality of Columbus? And how does that relate to current contemporary politics? Exact same things happening here.
So as you say, myths are powerful, even like in modern day current events happening this year and last year. It's there's new kind of mythology and old mythologies being strengthened as well. So do you think with movies that you're looking at then, how can you, or do you, can they be removed from the historical context in which they were made? And I know when you did the Braveheart episode, you were kind of looking at how it treated that century at the time, and was it realistic? And you know, what's the nature of history movies? What's the purpose of them? But also how that then affected thinking around gun control and militias in the 90s as well, and in the 2000s. So how closely do you think films are linked to the year that they're made, or the historical context that they're made in?
You know, that's an awesome question. You know, you really think about it. If you're going to analyze a work of art, once you start analyzing the historical context, you're also invariably going to be analyzing the artist themselves too. And where did they live? What were they thinking? And why were they making the art that they make? And I think there's two parallel tracks. Can you analyze the work of art as itself, as an isolated piece, and just discuss its merits individually without any context, without any artist intention? Or do you look at the historical context and you look at the artist making it and you ask, why did they make it? Why did they make these choices? And I think both are equally valid ways to debate and discuss art. And I don't think there's a clear yes or no. So our Apocalypse Now, if you want to understand the movie Apocalypse Now, you have to understand the Vietnam War, at least surface level. You don't have to be a historian. You don't have to have read any books, but you have to know there is a thing called Vietnam. It didn't go well for America, and a lot of people hated it, in order to understand that movie. So if you don't have that context, it's going to be a very difficult movie to even just understand what's happening, because they don't explain the war at all. They don't explain why they're fighting the war. They don't really explain why in the movie, they go to Cambodia. They don't explain where Cambodia is. Why is Cambodia even involved in the Vietnam War? So you have to have some context there. Conversely, you can take a movie like Star Wars and you can enjoy it simply on its own merits. You can understand, yeah, George Lucas, he was developing new technologies. They revolutionized film. He was a student of Joseph Campbell and read Hero with a Thousand Faces and adapted that formula into the first movie. You can understand those things and they can help you, but you don't really need any of that to really analyze Star Wars. So I think there is a mix depending upon what lens you're taking. I always am going to go into the historical context because that's my passion. But you don't always have to. And it really depends on the work of art. You know, for example, you don't need any historical context in Leonardo da Vinci to be moved by the Mona Lisa. It is purely a thing of beauty. And it is amazing. In fact, you can walk in the Louvre and look at a lot of paintings with no context and your jaw can drop. And then if it inspires you to dig deeper, go down that rabbit hole. My favorite movie of all time is the movie Gladiator. I love the movie so much that I went back to school and got a degree, because I was a dropout in history, and studied ancient history, in particular Roman history. There is almost nothing historical about that movie at all. You know, very loose. There was a guy named Marcus Aurelius. There was an emperor named Commodus, but you know, the date that they have at the beginning, if I remember correctly, is actually not the date or that Marcus Aurelius reigned. Commodus didn't die in the gladiatorial pit. He was obsessed with gladiators, though. That is true. He used to, according to the sources, Commodus used to dress up like Hercules, go into the gladiatorial pit, and have people he didn't like just thrown into the pit, and then he would just cut them down with a club and club them like he was Hercules. Yeah, he's not a good dude. But there's nothing historical about it at all, yet it inspired me to actually go learn the history. And if it inspires you to dig deeper, go for it. Do you have to do that to enjoy a piece of entertainment and art? No, you really don't. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you choose to, then I'd say go for it and dig into the historical context.
Yeah, that's a really good answer and really good kind of strategy to go on. And like you say, like Star Wars, yes, there's a big historical context around that, even though it's kind of removed from history and it removes itself from from this universe by saying a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So it removes itself from our history, but then that could only really be made in the 70s when you had those particular elements all coming together in the Apollo program. And you know, there is historical context there, but it also removes itself and can be enjoyed on its own merit. In terms of thinking about the artists and can the art be removed from the artist, and you're saying, you know, they're both valid ways of looking at it and looking at the artist's intentions. I know that is something you've done a lot recently on Midnight Myth, is looking at some films that you've enjoyed and are good movies and good stories, but you've then removed kind of artist's intentions from there or examined it without the recent news about artists like kind of polluting how you view the films, even though you are aware of that. So I'm thinking of examples like the Braveheart one. You talked about Mel Gibson and how he's kind of become a problematic figure in terms of possible anti-Semitism and some other accusations, and J.K. Rowling as well, and some of her views that she's come out with. You were still able to study Harry Potter and look at that, but you made a very clear statement about that you were deliberately separating this, and you acknowledged the news about J.K. Rowling, but still looked at those films on their own as well.
Yeah, it's tough when someone makes something that you love and you find out that they're a total jerk and they're a terrible person. Another one that came to mind is, you know, Kevin Spacey is one of the greatest actors alive and is, you know, just a terrible, horrible human being. And you know, we live in this weird time. This is just sort of my own riff on this. We live in a weird time where the idea of a private and public self is changing. You know, back before social media revolution things, people were expected to have both a public life and a private life, and it was okay that they weren't consistent. I'll give you a historical example that a lot of people may not like. Thomas Jefferson is considered a problematic American founding father. Our third president, he owned a lot of slaves and he kept a slave as a mistress. And the children from that relationship, he owned as slaves. He enslaved his own children. Absolutely horrible when you think about that. As a new parent, I can't imagine having someone I claim to love have a child and then keeping that child in bondage in any form whatsoever. Thomas Jefferson also did more for the abolitionist movement, arguably, than any other founding father, which is really hard. He introduced a bill in the Virginia Assembly before the Revolutionary War to outlaw slavery. It failed. When he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he put a long sequence about slavery and how the British Empire could never, ever be a free empire as long as it was comfortable selling slaves. And that offended his other Southern, you know, revolutionary founding fathers. So they removed that. But he also penned the word, "All men are created equal," which has been the rallying cry of every attempt Americans have to be a freer, fairer, more inclusive republic. So Thomas Jefferson has a huge legacy of laying the groundwork to end slavery, for women's rights, for gay rights. Like, all of those things do not happen without Thomas Jefferson and what he did. But his private self, he was a horrible and just a horrible human being. And we look at that now, and rightly so, say that there's a lot of hypocrisy there. Like, what a hypocrite. You're saying all men are created equal and you're enslaving your children. But in that time, in that context, people were allowed and expected to have a public self being one thing and a private self being another, almost like dual identities. Today, we don't have that. No one is really allowed a private self in the way that they used to. And now we're seeing all of these creators who have made this amazing artwork. We are now, since they don't have a private selves, we're seeing a lot of their personal demons and they're laid to bear. And it's tough because you love Harry Potter and then J.K. Rowling opens her mouth or goes on Twitter and says something and you're just scratching your head. Like, how can you, who wrote Harry Potter, be a bigot of any type? Harry Potter is very much a story against bigotry and bullying and oppressive authorities telling people what they can and cannot do. And here she is privately, when not creating artwork, a bigot in one fashion or another. And it does make it hard. You know, some say, if it turns out that you're a bad person, that's it. We can't support it. And for me, I'm always torn because Harry Potter is a very important piece of artwork for me, even more so for my wife, Laurel. Like, it is her most favorite piece of artwork, most influential piece of artwork. How do you purge it from your life when it means so much to you? Yet when supporting it, you're supporting someone who has really bad views. And I don't know the answer to this problem. I just know that I know the line for me when I see it, and it's not a etched in stone. It's gray. And yeah, it's tough. I don't know. What do you think?
It's tough, isn't it? Because like I still like the Harry Potter books. And I think, I don't know, my problem with some of the books is more to do with plot holes and things rather than the, like, as you say, the intentions behind the book, because the intentions come out very good, I think, in there. Like, it is an anti-racism book. It's an anti-bigotry. It's a, you know, let's build a stronger world together kind of book. And so the messaging in Harry Potter, I really don't see a problem with. I think it's really strong. But then you compare it to what you said. And yeah, I don't know. I suppose people also vote with their wallets as well, don't they? So is it like, well, I've already bought that, but I'm not going to buy any more. And maybe that's how they distinguish it. And it is possible to look at work on its own and judge it by its own merits. But then, as you say, the more you know about the author, you always have that little something in the back of your mind as well, don't you? But I mean, I would still watch Harry Potter and read Harry Potter. Less likely to go and seek out new work by that author, I would say as well. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's really, really, really hard. Is Beat It any less of a good song by Michael Jackson now that we know the truth about him? The answer is no, that song is still as good of a song as it was, even though a monster made it, you know, and it's hard in this era where we expect and want, I think rightly so, like we want the people we idolize to reflect, you know, being a decent human being. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But at the same time, if we purge the art that was made by bad people, we would be left with little art, you know, because most of it is made by bad people on one avenue or another. That's true in music, especially with rock and roll and the men of rock and roll. Like, so at the same time, it's like, okay, if everyone that has a tough or problematic view we don't want to support, we're not going to have a lot left. At the same time, I don't think it's wrong for us consumers of art to be like, could you not turn out to be a monster if you're going to be a hero that I'm going to, you know, I'm going to share that artwork with my son? You know, so I do not have the answer on this one. I really don't. I know that for Laurel and I, we carefully select what we want to talk about. And if we want to talk about something that we think could be offensive or could be triggering or could rub people the wrong way, we want to make sure that we're transparent about that. And say, you know, so when we did the Harry Potter, we did every movie, we gave 100% of our Patreon money, which is not a lot, but of the patrons that we have, we gave all of it to organizations that support trans rights, 100% of it. So for us, it was like, hey, if we're going to do this, we're also going to personally take a stand that we are a pro trans rights podcast, 100%. And we do not support transphobia at all. Does that balance it out? I have no idea. You know, I honestly don't have the answer on this one.
But it's a recognition, isn't it? And I think it's maybe hard in that you can obviously still appreciate the quality of a work of art, but maybe it diminishes sometimes your love of that work of art. Like for me, it's certain, I would say it links to football. I'm a big soccer Newcastle fan. You know, certain players who've scored amazing goals in the past, and that goal is still amazing, but then you learn more about that player and you're like, yeah, I used to be in love with that player, but I'm not anymore, but it still stands as a great goal and you can kind of remove it yourself that way, but it does kind of, I don't know, diminish your love for them a bit as well. You've given us a little insight there into some of the thought processes around when you are choosing a film and other things you consider. How do you choose the films and what's the process of making a Midnight Myth episode and choosing the films that you want to cover?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. We don't have a formula about how we choose it. We literally will just sit and talk and be like, what do you want to do next? We have a spreadsheet with ideas, thoughts, works of art that we want to analyze, ways that we may want to tackle it. So if we find that we're running out of ideas, we have like a well that we can go pull from. We usually try to keep things sort of consistent from episode to episode, unless we feel like we've gone stale and need to change it up. So we did Bram Stoker's Dracula, and we loved it and had so much fun doing it. We're like, we're not really done with Coppola yet. We want to do something else. So then we did an Apocalypse Now. So now we're thinking, okay, so we've done two Francis Ford Coppola movies. Should we do a third? Should we add in The Godfather to that? Or should we maybe try another great director? So we're thinking about doing a series on auteur directors. Then again, after doing Apocalypse Now and how heavy that was, and that was a draining episode to do because there's a lot of history and it's a really, really intense work of art. There's part of me that's like, maybe we should do a Pixar movie next and just like lighten the mood a little bit. But yeah, if we love the work of art and we have something to say, those are really the only two things that we consider before going into selecting something. If we don't love it and we don't have something to say, we're not going to tackle it. We used to try to follow the sort of conversation online among other podcasters, on Twitter, on social media. Where is sort of like the geek nerd community at? What are they talking about? And we used to try to add to that conversation. And this was really early in the podcast. And we were miserable. It was a job. We were following what other people were saying. And like, what's our angle on it? What's the Midnight Myth going to say about X, Y, and Z? For example, the movie Joker. This was an inflection point. The movie Joker came out. The entire nerd community, everyone who liked cinema was talking about the Joker. Was it a good movie? Was it a bad movie? Was it problematic? Was it ingenious? You know, and everybody was talking about it. And I'm like, everyone's talking about it. We should talk about it too. The reality is Laurel and I just didn't love that movie. And we're like, everyone's said what needs to be said about this. We can't add anything to it. And that was the point where we're like, you know what? Let's just talk about what we love and what we have something to say about. We found one, we had more fun doing the podcast. And two, we started growing our listenership much better when we were just doing what we love to do, because I think it just came across a little more naturally. So that's really, really it. If we love it and we have something that we want to say, we're going to do a podcast on it.
That's really good advice, actually. And it really makes sense as well to be following the fun of what you want to do. And because obviously there's so many movies being out that haven't been explored, and certainly not explored in the depth that you guys at Midnight Myth do, with all the links with the history behind it and the mythology that parallels and the philosophy parallels as well. So got all these movies that you control from history and from the history of cinema to bring in there. So why not, you know, follow your interests in there? Do you have any hints about what might be coming up? Is it just that you may be following these auteur directors? Maybe is that one of are you still not decided on the next few episodes?
We're not settled on where we're going next. We just finished watching all four seasons of the television Fargo. So we're thinking a lot about absurdism and cosmic irony. And if we have an episode in there, around there, and we haven't done a lot of work with the Coen brothers. So we've done one Coen brothers movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And that was years ago. So we're thinking about maybe doing a series on the Coen brothers, but we'll see. Follow us on Twitter at The Midnight Myth. We'll tell you as soon as we know. We will absolutely share it.
I was going to just ask about how people can follow you. So it's Twitter, it's at Midnight Myth on Twitter. How else can people follow you and join the podcast?
So we're on every podcast app that you can go, just The Midnight Myth podcast, search for us, we'll find it. Apple, Google, whatever. Spotify too, I think. Twitter is a place where we're probably the most active. Not as much as we used to be with the baby. So we're not as glued to our phones as we used to be. We're also on Instagram and Facebook. Just search The Midnight Myth Podcast. My Twitter is DerekJones198 at Twitter. So if you're hitting us up on social media, 99.9% of the time, you're going to be talking to my wife, Laurel. And she is the smarter and better half of The Midnight Myth. That's fine. But if you want to dumb it down and talk to me, you can find me there. Oh, we have a website, www.midnightmyth.com. We have Patreon. We have a contact forum. We have merch. If you want to throw us some money, great. Or if you just want to go, we do put blogs on there. Again, since the baby, we're not blogging as much as we used to. But yeah, that's how you can find us.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much. Honestly, I really recommend Midnight Myth. If you love movies and love, you know, chatting in depth about movies, it's a really good place to go. I really like the depth that you go to and those links with mythology and history and philosophy. But it also, I feel like it's an engaging kind of way. Like, it's very friendly. So I managed to get a drink with my mates yesterday, and it's kind of the conversations we were having about the movies. I feel like that's the vibe of the podcast. So it's really accessible in that way as well.
Yeah, thank you. And that is the idea. We just like to have a conversation. So Laurel and I just took the conversations we were having about art and we just started recording them. Absolutely.
Well, it just means just to say thanks very much for coming on, and good luck to yourself and to Laurel for your next episodes.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Big thanks and love to my wife, and thank you, Andy, for having me.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dream Swarm podcast. I've been your host, Andy Mark Simpson. We hope you'll join us for the next one. Remember, you can subscribe to stay in touch with future episodes
and follow us at the website www.dreamswarm.org or follow on Twitter and Instagram at Dreamswarm.
And we look forward to joining you for more supernatural film stories and art. In the meantime, be creative, be curious, be kind.
We'll see you soon.